I'm Jackie Morris. I'm the Senior Clerk of Committees, and it's my privilege to chair the next session, which is on whether the performance of committees can be measured. Our speakers are Dr. Phil Larkin and Mr. Francis Sullivan. Dr. Larkin's a lecturer in public policy at the University of Canberra, and in addition to his academic research, he has worked as a researcher for both Australian Senate committees and the Committee Office of the House of Commons in the United Kingdom. Mr. Sullivan has been Secretary General of the Australian Medical Association since 2008, and prior to that he was the Chief Executive Officer of Catholic Health Australia for nearly 14 years. So if you could join me in please welcoming Dr. Larkin.
Thank you. Having also had the privilege to speak at an event to celebrate an anniversary of the House committees a couple of years ago, I also feel like something of a gatecrasher at these events. You've heard loads of people with extensive committee experience in the Senate. Mine is limited, a couple of shortish secondments, enjoyable but short. And that hardly qualifies me as an expert. And, of course, I'm a POM, so I also feel I'm intruding slightly in that respect, too. I'm moving back to London at the end of the year, so I'm going to be gatecrashing rather less, regrettably. But before I go, and I would like to abuse my position up here to publicly thank the staff of both the Senate and the House, who have been unbelievably generous to me with their time and cooperation with my research. They've unfailingly delivered information that I've been too daft, too useless to find for myself. They've given me their time, they've given me their resources, their support, and I would like to publicly thank them very sincerely for that. On to the main task. Can committee performance be measured? There's a short and a long answer to that. The short answer is yes, of course. The long answer, if you rephrase the question slightly differently, can it be measured effectively, then the answer is slightly more complicated. I don't have extensive experience of committee work, I met decades like many of the speakers to draw on, so I'm going to, this speech will be slightly more general, a wee bit more esoteric perhaps, but thought-provoking, I hope. Before I start on the issue of why, whether you can, I'd like to consider why you might bother trying to measure committee performance, which is a good starting point. There's two types of answer. There's a political science answer. With my academic hat on, the answer is because they're there. Academic political science scientists like to measure stuff. They like typologies. We like to categorize and classify things. So strong committee systems, weak committee systems. And assessing committee performance in that could just be another aspect of that activity. In that sense, measuring committee performance provides a sort of care in the community role for academics. It keeps us off the street. It keeps us out of trouble. God knows what we'd get up to if we didn't have these things to keep us entertained. More interestingly, more importantly, the reason for doing it relates far more to concerns about the quality of parliamentary processes and democratic processes more generally. The reason you might want to measure committee performance is because committees are generally and increasingly seen as a good thing. They are seen to add something to parliamentary processes that other institutions of parliament don't deliver. So you might want to assess how well that role is being performed. Reflecting on that, a number of the sort of international democracy promotion bodies have explicitly identified committees in their sort of assessment frameworks, and they've been looking at ways of trying to assess committee performance in various ways, and I'm in the middle of trying to write something which explains how they're not really doing it very successfully yet. I haven't finished it, but I can field some questions on that if you like later on. But to paraphrase one academic attempt to measure committee performance, the reason you might want to do this is because a strong committee system seems to be a prerequisite of a strong legislature, and strong legislatures are increasingly seen as a good thing. On that point, it's probably worth pausing for a moment to consider why we actually have committees at all. What are the positive things that they're thought to bring? Well, firstly, they provide just a division of labour. If you've got a number of committees, you can process more parliamentary business. You can get parallel, you know, bills going through simultaneously rather than waiting in line to be dealt with one after another. But at least in relation to Westminster systems more generally, it's worth bearing in mind that the committees, you know, unlike continental Europe, for instance, committees in the Westminster systems don't have their roots in the scrutiny of legislation, but rather in the sort of ex post scrutiny of government spending and government activity. So what else can they do? Well, expertise. We've heard quite a lot yesterday about the way in which committees that specialise according to their policy area or their type of legislation can develop genuine expertise, and with that they can better scrutinise legislation, or they can better hold government to account. They're better equipped to ask government the sorts of difficult questions it might not want to answer. We've heard various examples of that yesterday, as I say. Linkage. This is an area that Professor Ian Marsh, who's now at the University of Tasmania, who many of you will have read or met, is very big on. In an era when party politics, parliaments are seen as increasingly distant from the public, the fact that committees work publicly, they take submissions, they hold hearings, they engage with groups that might be, and individuals that might be outside the normal political machinery, it's seen as giving legitimacy, transparency to the process, and also in doing so increasing the quality, improving the quality of legislation. Consensus politics, again, this is something which we heard individual examples of yesterday a lot. The fact that committees, and particularly bearing in mind this is Westminster, a classic adversarial tradition, that committees can modify that adversarialism. You know, the idea is that small groups develop a sort of ethos of give and take, a sort of shared esprit de corps, if you like. And moreover, because they rely on evidence submitted to them, that sort of confronts the established party positions. And that's one that Andrew Bartlett made, I think, quite forcibly in the session I chaired for him yesterday. So, on to the main thing. How do you assess committee performance? Well, the obvious way is to look at their formal powers. You look at the standing orders and see what committees can do what. However, this is a very imperfect guide. Famously, an example I always give on this, and the example most people give on this, is the example of Japan and the US Congress. The US Congress has one of the most powerful committee systems in the world, probably the most powerful committee system in the world, whereas the Japanese Diet's committees are, to quote, an exercise in futility. And yet, the Diet's committees were modelled on the US Congress. They share very, very similar formal powers, and yet one is incredibly powerful, and one is an exercise in futility. So it's not so much formal powers that are the issue, it's what you actually do with them. So the obvious thing to do is to look at what committees actually do. If you look at the annual reports of various, the Office of the Senate, or the one I'm familiar with the House of Commons, produce a new, every year produce a sort of telephone directory side report on their annual activity and spending, you'll find various records of what they've got up to for the year, what the committees have got up to for the year. They you know, it lists the number of reports tabled, it lists the number of hearings they've held, the number of submissions received, number of trips they've gone on, amount of money they've spent. So it shows activity in some respect, and you could look at that. But I don't know that these sort of input measures, which is what they are, even though they're treated as an output in this context, actually tell us a tremendous amount about performance in this respect. They don't tell you how effective the committee's been. It just tells you how busy they've been. Having said that, whilst they might not tell us a lot about how effective, they can clearly tell us how ineffective they've been. If there had been no reports tabled, no questions asked, no witnesses heard, no submissions received, then, you know, clearly that is useless. But the inverse doesn't necessarily hold true, that activity equals performance or effective performance. One way is to look at a more sophisticated way is to look at the impact of committees on legislation. And that's okay, you can look at the number of amendments that they make to bills that come through them. Now, obviously, not all amendments are the same, and a handful of amendments to really significant bills, I mean, important amendments to significant bills, are far more relevant and a far better gauge of performance than a load of minuscule amendments to insignificant bills. But you can weight that and control for that. So that's fine. However, I've just mentioned all the other things that committees do. I mean, legislation is only one part of, examining bills is only one part of what committees do. How do you catch your estimates in that? We heard a lot about estimates and how effective it's been. That would be totally, you know, all that sort of activity, or references, they would be excluded from that if you just look at legislation and amendments. So what else can you do? Well, you can look at committee recommendations and compare the government responses to them. Now, if somebody's actually tried doing this, albeit in the UK, the problem is government almost never, in fact, I would say never, says, you're right, we'd never thought of that. What a fantastic idea. We shall do that immediately. Well done. Thanks very much. I have never, ever seen that. What we found when we did this was that they usually say, yeah, all right, but we already thought of that, so we were doing it anyway, we just haven't told you. Occasionally they say, that's stupid, but rarely do you get this sort of open, you know, open-armed embrace of a committee recommendation. You could have always, we did try and do this actually, you could look at subsequent legislation rather than just the government response. Assume you get a government response, of course. You could actually look at legislation and try and look at committee recommendations that sort of slowly drip feed their way into legislation as a measure of influence. Which is theoretically possible. It's actually quite hard. And even if you can track that, it's very hard to prove direct influence. I mean, maybe everybody did just think of this simultaneously. You can't actually prove definitively, in the absence of a minister saying, you're right, bang to rights, we've never thought of that. It was your idea, well done. I mean, that, again, really very rarely happens. So in the absence of that, you know, you're assuming that the similarity between the two is actually influence. And it's also worth bearing in mind that what we found was that just by bringing a subject up can cause change. The specific recommendations might be rejected, but you know the committee's activities have caused action to be taken. So that's that also wouldn't be picked up in that. And then there's, of course, the possibility that committees can change public opinion and cause more indirect influence on government that way. Could you measure that? It's theoretically possible. It's incredibly difficult to do that consistently. I mean, you might be able to do it for individual instances, but to do that across a committee system over time, unbelievably hard. I haven't told you how to measure committee performance. I'm aware of that. I've told you how not to measure committee performance. And that's because if I had thought of how genuinely to measure committee performance, I would probably be a lot more senior than I currently am. It is a tricky one. It really is extremely tricky. And, of course, just to complicate things further, as Robert Ray mentioned yesterday, he mentioned how estimates actually caused change by public servants anticipating what was going to happen in the estimates committees. If governments start anticipating committee perspectives, I mean, that surely is the most effective committee system of all. How do you measure that? There would be no amendments. There would be no inquiries. There'd be certainly no hostile recommendations. Everything would be perfect. The committee would agree with the government entirely. So any attempt to measure that would, you know, you'd find it very hard to distinguish between an unbelievably inactive and weak committee system and an incredibly powerful one. And I honestly don't know how you deal with that. How the hell do you measure that? To end, just to add a further complication, I'd flag another couple of problems. One is what you measure against. I've mentioned how you might look at, you know, committee influence on policy, and that's ultimately what committees sort of do, either through bills or reference inquiries. But that's only one aspect. I've also mentioned consensus. I mean, if you prioritise process over or equal to outcome, you know, sure, you then look at the internal committee process and judge the effectiveness of the committee system there. And certainly some people have done that. There's measures of deliberation in Parliament now. And ranking system to do with that. The idea being, you know, nice consensual policy making is better than adversarial. The other thing is that simply there are no agreed benchmarks. How much committee influence is enough committee influence? Do you want more or less? When is too much enough? When is enough too much? And I honestly don't know. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily one that can be to resolve in the abstract, although I'm willing to try and work it. Anyway, I'll stop.
Call on Francis Sullivan.
Thank you. Good morning, and thanks for the invitation. And it was great to see present and former senators here. I was at the last time you had one of these, which is like 10 years ago, because I've been fronting Senate Estimates Committees for 17 years, primarily as an advocate. And I don't come to this discussion in any way as an academic reflector or someone with a burning passion for the intellectual nuances of the Senate. I come at this discussion as a practitioner to push a view, because that's what people like I do. We push a view. Because at the end of the day, for us, politics is about passion and voices and getting yours heard. And it doesn't matter. Thank you. There you go, I'm done. That's what I said 10 years ago. I knew it would work. What I really mean is that you use any opportunity, any forum, and any vehicle to get that voice heard. So when it comes to committees and their inquiries and their considerations, it's just another place. So, firstly, you know, one of the difficult things for committees in managing their performance is actually balancing the passions that come before them. The second thing is, in any other organisation we're involved with, if someone said, hello, welcome to your KPIs, your key performance indicators, this is called how you stay employed. That's what a key performance indicator really is to people. If I get those, they can't sack me. So if you look at the senators now in a new light, what do they have to really do not to be sacked? They don't have to listen to me. They have to win. And they have to, every now and then, make sure they're at the right number on the ticket in order to win. This is their core business. That's why when you talk about performance, don't forget what is in the back of their mind all the time, which is their obligations to the party, to their electorate, and to their bank account. Because all three, like the rest of us, that's the mixture. Then you get thrown into this job in the Senate on the committees. And so now you've got this huge ambiguity, because the Parliament may have a set of expectations for senators on committees. The Parliament, the thing in theory does, this is what you're meant to do: consider, reflect, review, judge and act. But as party members, there is another set of expectations. It's manage the political issue of the day in that committee. I'm trying to tell people to suck eggs here, but all I'm trying to do is to show you how we then understand what really goes on when you go to a committee. You've got to put your view in the context of how it's going to be heard. And we think most of what we say is being heard through a jaundiced perspective. It's not an academic exercise. So the way I looked at this time is to probably say three areas for how you judge performance. The first is, how does the committee perform? And in my experience, the committees have fluctuated, but generally there's been a trend towards more provocative interaction with the witnesses over the time. I think a lot of witnesses get intimidated by that if you don't go that often and if you don't have a thick Irish Catholic hide like I do. And if you are going there with an expectation that you're going to have a reasonable conversation and you get a little frustrated because they don't ask you the right questions, or they don't listen to your answer, or the second senator asks exactly the same question, or the senators are walking in and out of the room, or there's only two there when it starts, and you get this great apology that you've flown three people from across Australia to the hearing and there's more of you than them, and it was your money, your time. People get frustrated with that. And they begin to say, what's the point? Or secondly, that the government said, this is a massively important issue, you've got a day and a half to have the hearing, and you've got 13 hours to get the submission in, and then you spend a lot of resources on getting the submission up, and you don't even get a gig. And you get mentioned in the references, but not in the text. A lot of people go, what's the point? And particularly at the end of the day, when you've got a strong view, and it doesn't matter anyway because the government's got the numbers and that's the majority report, and then there's a minority report, and then it goes into the Senate and happens and falls on the numbers anyway. And people go, what's the point? So I think there's a bit of a people management issue there that the Senate committees could work on. If you actually ask people who are involved. And secondly, I think it's always impressive when you see the senators on both sides, in different parties, appearing to like each other. I think that's a great PR exercise. And it's good. It shows that being civil is still a value in our parliament. And I'm not trying to be cynical here. I think it is, a lot of people don't realise that senators might actually like each other. They certainly don't know if that's true in the House of Representatives, but they still think it's possible in the Senate. But I do think that's interesting to see how that performs. And but be mindful of the fact that if there becomes a provocative atmosphere, this in the end is counterproductive, because people then it influences the type of information that comes back from the witnesses. It flavours that information. And, you know, to be honest, it's not a place for politicians to grandstand, and we've seen that over the years. And you know, groups like mine and the one I used to work for, we planned for that, to be honest, and sort of I think played into it at times, if I have to be so honest. So it's not all one way. I do think the two-party system though hasn't helped. I sort of look forward to the days when we might have a lot of mini-parties running the whole show together. That'd be quite good. That's my father, actually. because it gives you a chance to actually have a coalition of ideas and a coalition of interests. We've got a text, I just say it, and that at a certain point. So that's how I think they perform. I'm watching time because I need to be pushed on, I know. I just wanted to say, I'm fiddling with this too much, right? I just wanted to say, when you look at what the committees produce for value add is an important point, isn't it? So if it's a legislation type committee, you can seriously say, this is a great opportunity for community groups, because this is the only time in my experience where if you want to get amendments to the legislation actually seriously looked at, it's the committee. You can go to a couple of senators and say, listen, this is what we need to get changed here. And depending upon their degree of interest in what you're on about, they may engage with you, or they may say, look, I'm not worried about the amendments yet. Let's talk about the big level stuff. The amendments will flow through at the appropriate time. And depending upon the experience of the senator, they can manage you really well and actually can manage you right out of it. So the idea of putting it in the committees, at a legislation committee, is really good, because at least if you put it in your submission and you have it drafted already, it has to be looked at by someone. And then if you can seriously get that debated in the committee, or at least get it into one of the reports, and oftentimes in politics, if you've got a criticism and a solution, you're in the door. If you've got a criticism, people are like, hello, I'm tired. But if you've got a solution, at least they'll talk to you. You know, it's like life. It's like managing an 18-year-old. If you've got a solution, you at least have another day in your life. Okay? But what I'm getting at, I think the legislation committees are good that way. On the other one, the reference committees is okay, because it gives some groups a voice, but you must enable the groups to speak. And I have to say, it's all very fine for people like me, but, you know, there are many voices that don't get a gig. And I really feel that, I know committees are trying to bundle voices together, so sometimes you'll have a hearing and there's this array of people, because they're trying to be respectful of all the submissions, and they'll say, okay, well, this group here is generally coming with the same type of theme. But hello, if they're different groups, they have different themes. Governments like lobby groups to sort of be one. That's the government's need. That's not the lobby's need. So we need to think that through. I don't know how you do that. That's your problem. But it's just an issue. The trouble with that, of course, is, you know, all of us have to have our members seeing us doing things. So when you turn up with this gang of people, you've got to think of a really clever way of getting your voice heard. So it becomes a competition of information rather than quality. And then most of us, any brains, go outside and do a press release anyway and get yourself into the media one way or the other. I'll finish up very quickly. The two things. The last time I spoke at this, like I said 10 years ago, we had just had the passage, or in the process of the passage of the GST. And I had a lot to do with the Senator Harradine at the time. And if you recall that famous speech of his, I'm sorry Senator Mitchin left, because he would remember this day quite well. A few of us knew that Senator Harradine was going to do the speech that afternoon, and he walked into the chamber. And he began his speech and eventually said, you know, with regard to a GST, a tax on my children and my children's children, I think his words were something like, I cannot, if you recall that. As he gave the speech, the word around the Senate grew that something strange was going to happen here, because I think they didn't think he was going to do that. And all of a sudden, the government's benches started to fill. And one of the first person to walk into the room, because I was sitting upstairs, watched it, was Senator Minchin. Because they knew that now they had to deal with a new party. Senator Lees rang me that afternoon to say, it's wonderful, wonderful, we'll be talking to you on Monday. Well, Monday never came, of course, because we were lobbying for a particular outcome on that GST. But the Senate committees were helpful in getting a lot of junior voices up in those debates. But also it was a time of vibrance and activity in the Senate. It's been repeated many times since. But for me, it was a great learning about how someone not from a major party could actually be a voice. I'm not saying whether his voice is right or wrong, but I'm saying something that was potent. Passion and potency are important in politics. Three P's. Now, to finish with, I'd like to just go to one thing. It's frustrating for many groups to find the same inquiry all the time. Hello. How many inquiries on aged care have we had? Well, the best thing about the inquiries on aged care is we're all there now. Okay, it's taken so long. We are all there and we all get it. So you don't have to worry about, are elderly people important? Secondly, you can always pull the one out of the drawer when you're in trouble. So that's why I figure the reporting time is less. But the real point I wanted to make was, if you want to say, and I pick up Phil's point, if you want to take an inquiry, look at its recommendations and work out, does it have an impact? Well, when we had that famous inquiry on mental health back in 2006, that was a massive inquiry. We'd also had really good inquiries on poverty, if you recall. A good inquiry about the pension, which eventually there was action on some years later. So I really applaud the people who pushed that. We have to remember that the senators themselves take great commitment on these areas and work inside their own settings to promote things. I just want to say one quick thing in finishing. The mental health inquiry came up with 13 recommendations, and each of the recommendations generally had about three, if not four, sections to them. It was a great inquiry. Since 2006, only one of those recommendations has been enacted in full. One. In 2007, the Howard government came up with its own package for mental health and didn't refer to this thing at all. And now, in 2011, supposedly the Gillard government's going to come out with a big mental health package. Will they refer to the 2006 inquiry? Or will they do what governments often do, is redesign, recreate and refocus? If that is the case, then we have a problem of the disconnect. If it's not the case, then you can see that behind the scenes, reports are used. They may have to change, they may have to be nuanced, but there's something that worries me that in 2006, when so many resources, both parliamentary and community resources, went into something so profound, so important, such that we are facing the same dilemma today, let's all hope that that real thinking and passion is encapsulated in what the Prime Minister comes up with next year. Thanks very much.
So we have a few minutes for questions. Are there any questions? Jeff?
This is probably mostly for Dr. Larkin, but it does relate to Mr. Sullivan's points about the view from the other side of the witness table. And that is, I'm thinking, as a performance indicator, what about how the committee process and their reports are received by the stakeholders and the people who've been involved? I'm thinking that often you see bureaucratic reports now where in the front of it there'll be a little sheet with a few boxes in which you're invited to make some comments about what you think of the report. I'm just wondering whether you're aware that any Parliament or Congress has ever tried to sort of survey in an orderly way how their activities are received by the stakeholders who've contributed.
In an orderly way, no. I mean, having worked on committees, including yours briefly, it's something you're aware of and you monitor, as you know. But I don't know of any surveys as such. I have been involved in an ongoing research project which has you know, sort of canvassed opinions from people that submit to committees inquiries, and that's pending, to be honest. So I'll have to get back to you on that one.
We make sure that if we don't get mentioned in the report, we want to know why. And if our views don't get at least dealt with, you'd like to know why. And at times, you know, over the years, it's good to keep close to the person who's writing the draft, to be an assistance wherever possible. So that helps. But if a report happens and you just sort of, you know, can't work out, if you predict what the report can be often as a lobby group, but if you feel that, you know, there was something seriously missed there, you usually try and pressure the elected member accordingly, or the one that... So, yes, I mean... But then remember, the lobby groups that are well-resourced and loud are always involved somehow. That's part of the political theatre, and it's not always a value add. I get that, but that's what happens.
Other questions? Hello, I'm from the Law Council of Australia and have had some experiences the same as Francis there. We've had some positive outcomes when we've actually been consulted prior to a committee hearing by the department, which has led to government-sponsored amendments after the committee hearing, where the department has been able to also give evidence acknowledging some of the concerns that the profession has raised. I just wondered whether that's another outcome to throw into the mix of assessing performance of committees, and whether the AMA or other groups that you know of have also been able to establish those positive working relationships with the departments, either prior to the bill being introduced, which I guess is the ultimate, but if not, at least once the bill moves into the Senate.
You go ahead if you can.
I think it's, that is a great example of a successful lobby, if you can get that sort of outcome, and congratulations. Yes, there's been occasion when we know that a piece of legislation's gone in, there's great problems with it, and privately the government has realised that there might be an issue. And oftentimes it becomes some... I can remember a couple of times when we were asked to take your foot off the pedal a little bit in how you would express your views because a good result was going to come. And on other occasions, putting forward the amendment, it comes down to sometimes who prefers to lead with an amendment. But I think that, although not common, can happen. And I think the relationship with the department's fine. It's really not that relationship that matters in the end. It's the emotional engagement of the minister around having to change.
I'd just flag up, I mean, the role of pre-legislative scrutiny in that, and, you know, to bring in role for Parliament in that. I mean, you know, what's the harm? We don't always have to legislate in haste. I mean, if you're genuinely not sure, and you do genuinely want to get stakeholder views, chuck out a draft, get comments on that, and then introduce a bill for the technical working out.
I might just finish with one point there. I wanted to raise this. I'm sure it's of an interest. The frustration a lot of people have now is that governments put in sort of enabling legislation and leave everything important into regulations. So I've turned up at committee meetings where even the committee are like, hello, there's nothing here of substance for them to really address, and I think that's a real problem coming.
Would you join me in thanking both our speakers for a very thought-provoking... just before we break for morning tea, there'll be a brief tour of the old committee rooms in the old Parliament House here at the end of today's session. If anyone is interested in doing that, if they could register with the registration desk during morning tea. And with that, we'll break for morning tea.